Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last week, women captured a third of U.S. House nominations in Indiana, North Carolina, West Virginia, and Ohio. In all, 22 Democratic and 5 Republican female candidates won their respective primaries, and many of those women were underdogs in those races. Joining us now to talk about that and more is professor in the Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies Department at Ohio State University, Wendy Smooth. Welcome back.
Thank you. Glad to be back, Ann.
And joining us by phone, political consultant, former politics editor at the Cleveland Plain Dealer, Marianne Sharkey. Welcome back, Marianne.
Thank you, Ian.
How did women do in Ohio last week?
Oh, women did very well in Ohio. We in a number of races that I looked at, Ian, including one in up here in Cleveland with Sandra Williams for Ohio Senate. She was the only woman in a race that included two former state reps, Bill Patman and Jeff Johnson, and she won that one handily. I think what we're seeing here is that when you have like one woman in the race with multiple men, she's going to win.
It really stands out.
Yes, it does.
Wendy Smooth, what do you make of this? I mean, we're going to talk later about what will transpire, or what is expected to transpire in the general, but there's a lot of women running in primaries this year.
Absolutely. It's a lot of energy. I think we are seeing the results of women who started mobilizing early 2017 with the Women's March. We've seen women who are energized around the Time's Up campaign, Me Too campaign. And then you have what I would think of as a juggernaut of women who have always been active in politics. They may have been active at the very local level, who are finally deciding that it's my time.
You know, Marianne, I was looking at a photo caption. It was of a bunch of men celebrating a Republican victory somewhere, and it said that it looked like, you know, a Scandinavian village of Dockers wearers, you know, and in other words, they were generalizing, but they all sort of looked alike,
right,
and that kind
right,
of a thing.
Right.
Is there a generalization about the women who are running in these campaigns?
No, I don't think so. I mean, they seem to be coming from all different kinds of walks of life. I mean, many women who never really thought about running are thinking about it now because of the Me Too movement. And it's clear that, we used to say that women had a 5-point advantage. I think I would guess it's up to 7 or 8 points at this point, because women are starting to vote for women. And I think it's not just, the women who are running, it's also the women who are getting more and more active in all campaigns. We're just seeing a lot more women volunteers. We're seeing more women take active roles. We're seeing more women consultants, like someone like myself.
Mm-hmm.
It's just energizing women, period.
I wanted to talk about the backdrop of women behind these candidates. Are they giving them the real story? Are you telling female candidates, Marianne Sharkey, when you have them to work with, how hard it is?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I've always explained to all the candidates I've ever worked with that, you know, it's a 24/7 job. You don't get a day off when you run. And it's very difficult. Women tend to have, families and other obligations, but they just have to figure out a way to get someone to help them maintain their households or whatever their businesses are. And they've got to just, bear down, much like the men have always done. Women have just got to set aside everything and run as a candidate. And that's their full-time job.
Except that traditionally, men have always foisted it on the women. The women don't necessarily have that luxury. Wendy Smooth, there's some cultural obstacles here.
Oh, for sure. And women don't necessarily receive the same reception when they're knocking on the door with their kids and saying, please vote for me. And so they have to be ready for the question of, are you neglecting your children with this decision to run for office? And so people who are training candidates have to get the verbal language into candidates' mouths about how to respond to things that really can take you aback. I mean, these are the same things that people said to folks like Shirley Chisholm in the 1970s, right? Shouldn't you be home with your husband? What does your husband think about you running for office? And unfortunately, women still encounter some of those same types of responses. But when we see the guys out campaigning with the kids, we go, oh, aren't they adorable? Very different reception.
It reminds me, my mom ran for county commissioner when I was in high school, and she put a photo of the whole family with the five kids and the spouse in the campaign lit, and she said it was the biggest mistake she ever made.
Oh, wow.
You know, that was back in the day.
Sure.
So especially in that era. Yeah. I don't run into that so much anymore. A lot of the women who are running for office these days, you know, quite frankly, are a little bit older, and children are, you know, more out of school or just about or in high school. Mm-hmm. So I don't run into the, you know, a lot of candidates who have small children.
Well, that's certainly the trend and the traditional route for women, that women have gotten the message to wait until the kids are a little older. It's not your time while you're parenting. And that actually, the overall system of moving women through the pipeline gets slowed when women will wait until their kids are school age or until they have an empty nest to actually take that first step into politics. That slows the overall pipeline of getting women into office, getting them into that first office so that they could run for the next position. And so we have to figure out ways that we can support women candidates who are parenting, women candidates who have elder care responsibilities or other responsibilities, and support them. So groups that are interested in funding campaigns can also think about, how do we fund child care in relationship to campaigns and things like that.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about women in politics again after the historic numbers of successful candidates in the primaries in West Virginia, Ohio, North Carolina, and
Indiana,
right. Okay, so last week, Pennsylvania and others are today. That's a big one in Pennsylvania. We'll be talking about that. My guest by phone, Marianne Sharkey, political consultant, former politics editor for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, and also Wendy Smooth. She teaches women's gender and sexuality studies at The Ohio State University. Tell us what you think. What are the obstacles, and what are the pratfalls moving forward for women in politics? 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Marianne and Wendy, another thing my mom told me was that she got a lot of women who at the time when she was running, would say, why do you want to get involved in that nasty business? There was definitely a feeling about politics that it wasn't a nice thing to do.
I think that's true, Ian. And you know, you do have to prepare women that it's a blood sport. seriously, they have to, you know, they have to get tough to be able to do this. And you know, I don't mean to generalize about women, but they tend to, you know, they tend to take this personally, and I think more so than men do. And so you really have to harden and toughen them up and make sure that they know that, you know, this is a nasty business, and it's gotten a lot nastier, you know, in the last couple of years.
Sure, it's definitely gotten a lot nastier. But it's interesting, voters actually in this type of environment actually think of women as the ones who can do the cleanup, who can play fair, who can bring civility to our governing institutions. And so that tends to be very appealing for voters. Now, the problem with that is that if women are a part of, as Marianne spoke of, the dirty get down, they're penalized more severely for that kind of dirty play.
Do you think that played a role?
I think we saw that with Mary Taylor.
Right.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I think we really saw that in her campaign.
And everything about the campaign said, get tough, be tough, come out swinging, come out hard. And we saw that
in our Ohio races up and down the primary ballot, that kind of get tough language.
Yeah.
But it played very differently for women than it did for men.
You know,
I agree with you. I think that's true. I think women have a harder time getting into the mud pile.
But conversely, I remember back when Lee Fisher was running against Betty Montgomery Attorney General, and he lost. And some people blame the fact that he went tough on Betty Montgomery and whether she, what kind of deal she cut with sexual assault perpetrators, you know, people convicted of sexual assault, what kind of sentencing deal she cut and went soft on, you know, whatever rapists or whatever the catchphrase was. And that was just considered back then very untoward. Now we have Mike DeWine calling Mary Taylor, I don't know, just calling her all sorts of names in this. It didn't seem to bug anybody this time, right?
Well, they were both rather than nasty campaigns.
They were.
So maybe they offset each other. But I think Mary Taylor had the added problem, you know, as I analyzed her race, is that she ran as the candidate for the white guys, for the Tea Party, for the NRA. And I'm not sure that that was the right strategy for a woman candidate for governor.
Why?
Because I think that if she's going to get the women's vote, she has to go. She has to move away from being a. I mean, she was against the Medicaid expansion, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we know from our internal polling that women in Ohio are in favor of the Medicaid expansion. We also know that women in Ohio are concerned about guns. So those were two issues that she missed on.
I never got the feeling she was shooting for the female vote.
I don't think so either.
Yeah.
But it would have helped her.
Sure, if there could.
She lost big time.
Sure, if there had been some middle ground that she could play or just left the gun.
Get the gun at home at the rally.
That's a capital step for the assault back in the year.
Right.
She was packing that day.
Yeah, she was packing. Yeah.
all right. So then on the other side of that is. You know, she was shooting for that white male vote. The white male vote didn't show up in the numbers she was hoping for. Obviously, she lost by something like, I don't know, how many percentage points?
About 20.
20, yeah, just about 20.
Yeah.
So is where do women fare better among, you know, does it matter what party you're in terms of faring better among male voters, Wendy Smooth?
It matters across the board which party you're in for women. And we hopefully will get a chance to talk about that when we get to the national races as well. But women do far better with the Democratic Party than they do with the Republican Party. And, I mean, you know, Mary Taylor's case, she was running at, you know, more extreme conservative. But for Republican moderate women, this is just the toughest time ever for them in terms of being able to speak to the gun-carrying white male.
The primary voters.
Primary voters, right. Yeah. Absolutely. So they don't make it through. The moderate Republican women have a very tough time making it through.
Well, so we have a Mary Taylor who's right wing,
exactly.
And then you're saying the moderates don't either, so.
So I would say Republican women overall have struggles that are different than Democratic women. And we see that in the different energy right now between the two parties. You see many more Democratic women running.
Just running in the beginning, let alone finishing.
Right.
We're going to continue our conversation. That's Wendy Smooth. She's a professor in the Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies Department at OSU. Also, Marianne Sharkey, political consultant, former politics editor at the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Coming up, we'll have another voice in the conversation. We'd like to add yours, so give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Women captured a third of U.S. House nominations in Indiana, North Carolina, West Virginia, and Ohio primaries last week. In all, 22 Democratic and 5 Republican women secured nominations in those races. Today, we're talking about women in politics again, because it's not necessarily been dubbed the year of the woman, but it's certainly they're certainly showing up on the ballots this year. Still with us is professor in the Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies Department at Ohio State, Wendy Smooth. Also by phone, political consultant, former politics editor at the Cleveland Plain Dealer, Marianne Sharkey. And joining us as well by phone, director at the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers University, Debbie Walsh. Welcome back, Debbie.
Nice to be with you again. Nice to be with Wendy again.
Yes, that's right.
Hi.
You've said that despite the recent success at the primary level, this is a marathon, not a sprint. Can we talk about what you mean by a marathon? Are we talking about a half marathon? Or what are we talking about here, Debbie Walsh?
Okay, is it right? So, you know, I guess what we've been talking about lately is really wanting to kind of rein in the expectations so that the expectations about what happens at the end of the day, meaning after November, are realistic, and that we think about how we want to measure success. So I think we absolutely have to measure the success of women being engaged and involved and stepping up and running. And that is a tremendously good news story because, as Wendy knows, we have been talking for decades about the fact that, you know, when women run, they win at about the same rate as men do in comparable races, but we just aren't seeing the women running. And this year, we are seeing the women running. But we are also seeing in this year a lot of women running as challengers in for seats that are strongly not the party that they are in. And that is a real challenge. And so we need to be conscious of that because my concern is at the end of the day, if women don't double their numbers in Congress, that what we're looking at is the women sort of being seen as failures, when in fact they are taking on tremendously difficult races. When you talk about how many women won in those primaries last week, those numbers are great, but 16 of those women are running as challengers, and 12 of them are running against solidly favored incumbents. So these are really tough races, and I think we want to just kind of keep all of this in some perspective and think about how we measure the success. On top of that, it's also important to note that we have a record number of incumbent women in Congress, in the House at least, who are not running for reelection. We have 13 women who are not running for reelection, which means to just stay where we are, we have to elect 13 new women to Congress.
And the odds of that?
It's tough. I mean, we've seen it happen in 2012. I think we had about 19 new women get elected, and the record we ever saw in terms of new women getting elected was back in 1992 when 24 new women were elected. But it's tough. I mean, this progress is slow. I think this year has potential for us to see pickup, but I don't want the expectation to be that because we have so many women running, we're going to see a skyrocketing number of women coming into office. The one place where we have seen some real progress over time, because we've really seen stagnation in Congress for the last number of cycles.
And state houses as well.
Sure. And state houses as well. But where we have seen growth is among women of color. And that's what we are also watching in particular in this cycle is, you know, when we get through these primaries, how many of these women are women of color, and are they well positioned so that we continue to see growth among women of color?
What do you think, Wendy Smooth?
So, of course, I agree with everything Debbie has articulated. We've had these conversations for a lot of years about this being the long, long game. I've said to people over and over again this year, I am most interested not necessarily in what's happening at this midterm, but really what does this set up for 2020? What does this set up down the line, and which women are being positioned by getting their name out, getting the high name recognition that comes with running a first campaign, and what happens to them next? The other thing I throw additional caution into the conversation about how do we measure success is because the structural arrangements are a little bit different in this election cycle than we saw in 1992, which we've, you know, labeled the year of the woman, right? So one of the big things that happened during that time period as well, or that year, was that we had gone through redistricting, the redistricting process. There were a number of open seats. We had just started to support majority-minority districts. And so the numbers that Debbie is referencing in terms of the doubling of the number of women of color in Congress were largely the result of the creation of majority-minority districts. And so at this midterm election, we don't have those same types of structural arrangements in place. And so I underscore, as Debbie said, a lot of these women who are running against incumbents who have an incredible incumbent advantage. We know their names. We've seen their mailings.
They have
money.
We've
seen them on television, and they have money. We often encourage women historically to run in, you know, for open seats where you have a lot more opportunity and possibility because you're not coming against that strong incumbent.
Marianne Sharkey, is there a shortcut short of scandal?
A shortcut? There's no shortcuts in politics. No.
Right.
But, you know, I'm not as concerned as they are. Maybe they're concerned on a national level about, you know, that the women did not succeed. But what I like, the fact is they're getting into the pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
They're
certainly
getting the experience. They're getting to, you know, it's hard for women to raise money. And so, I mean, I'm glad and I'm heartened to see so many taking, you know, taking part in the process. And I think, you know, as Wendy mentioned, I think we're looking at the long game here. And mm-hmm. the long game is to get them organized, get them in the pipeline, get them have the experience, get them to get around town, go to the right places, meet with the right folks, and just go out and campaign. And the campaign experience is great for women.
You know, Anne, this is Debbie. I just wanted to say that we've been talking a lot about here at COP about the idea that we want to under-promise and over-deliver. And I think that's really what we would want to try to do here, which is let's set the expectations realistically. If we exceed them, fantastic. If we come in, you know, and have moderate gains, then it helps build the momentum. My concern is I love the concept of women getting in, that they're getting name recognition if they're in it for the long haul. I worry about discouragement. I worry that if the expectation is way up here, and when that doesn't happen, women say, I'm going home, I'm not playing anymore. That's a problem. I also want to talk about one other thing that I see as a measure of success before we even get to November is the FEC ruling last week about the use of campaign funds for child care.
Yes.
Whether or not the woman who filed that petition that asked for it and got it wins or loses, that is a win for women. It's just one more of the challenges, and this allows women or men to use raised campaign funds for child care costs related to the campaign. So if the candidate needs to go out and campaign at a time when she wouldn't normally be having child care, then she can use, or he can use, that money for child care. That takes one of those challenges away, and I think it opens up the door. It's important on a gender basis, but also class. And so I just think we have to look for those wins where we see them, and that one is a long-term win.
Right. It has deep. It could grow deep roots in the future. It's hard for women to raise money, you said, Marianne Sharkey. It's
yes.
also hard. That, I mean, for that, women are less likely than men to give money.
That is true, too. They don't seem to have the same commitment. But, you know, a lot of women are not partners in their law firm. We're getting more and more women who are partners mm-hmm. in law firms or vice presidents of their companies. You know, the kind of purchase where you can get a lot of money out of law firms. You can get a lot of money out of a business. And women, as they gradually get into these positions, will probably be able to have bigger checkbooks. But right now, we're still struggling in that area.
Building that resume, Wendy Smooth, a lot of women, I wrote a column many years ago analyzing the Strickland administration. I could have done any administration at the time, and having to be a Democrat, governor, looking at their appointments to commissions and boards and how women were a fraction of what men were to begin with. And most of, if not all, a vast majority of the paid positions, the ones that compensated, went to men.
Oh, and that's still a challenge.
The building resume
women,
thing.
The building the resume thing. And a number of groups for a while were focused on how do we diversify our boards and our commissions. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the leadership groups in town at one point were focused on getting women positioned for that because it does make a difference in politics in terms of appointments, as you mentioned. So I want to also speak a little bit to Mary Ann's point about women and political giving. I think we do have to train women around philanthropy and politics. But the other thing is that more recently, there's encouragement from, you know, the new Obama strategy of lots of small donors. And so women may find that many small donors is the recipe for their success. Certainly the big checks make a huge difference. But if you're amassing a greater number of smaller checks, that also is an additional strategy, particularly for women of color. We find that women of color give beyond their socioeconomic status when we actually do the analysis.
In general.
In general, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But there's also a lot of small checks in that. And so I hate for us to discount the idea that a small check can make a difference for a candidate.
I just want to add one thing to that also, which is that basically we do know from looking at the numbers that women are raising, it may be harder for them,
right,
but they are raising comparable amounts of money to men in comparable races. But as Wendy says, it may be through those smaller donations. It in fact happens because, as Marianne was saying, they may come from less moneyed networks, right?
Mm-hmm.
The networks they have don't have the same dollars to or disposable income. But I do think that Wendy is right, that we have to talk about this and I think in some ways retrain women to think about their giving and investing those dollars in politics, not just in nonprofits and philanthropy.
Debbie, what about the dark money? How are women doing with the dark money?
Well, you know, there haven't been particularly good studies that are looking at that. You know, I think you're talking about sort of super PAC money.
Yeah, correct.
And you know, it seems that women, you know, they're not at a huge disadvantage in the super PAC money. I mean, the reality is that Emily's List happens to be one of the strongest and best independent expenditure organizations out there, supporting women candidates. I do not consider them dark money. I consider them an organization that is working hard to level that playing field and make up for some of the ground that we were just talking about of the challenge that women have raising money. And I think there are a lot of really important and good new PACs out there that are trying to raise money to support women candidates.
Well,
organizations like Higher Heights that is doing that for Black women. There's Poter PAC targeting Latinas, you know, and I think that kind of money where we're looking at, you know, really trying to target and help women candidates can make a difference.
As far as Emily's List goes, are they back on track supporting only women candidates, Debbie Walsh?
They've always supported.
Well, they didn't in Ohio in a Senate race, a primary race. They supported the male.
They gave money to a male candidate?
Yeah. Lee Fisher. Really? Do you remember, Marianne?
Yes, I do remember that.
Mm-hmm.
When was that?
Oh, he was running against the secretary.
90s, wasn't it?
90, Anne? Okay.
90, yeah. I don't know what year, but it was in the 90s,
right?
Yeah, I've not heard of that. I mean, they are, as far as I know, a PAC that supports pro-choice Democratic women,
right?
Mm-hmm.
They are doing that now and supporting not just at the congressional level, but also at the state legislative level. And, you know, they have been a major player and a major reason that we've seen the growth. When you look at the disproportionate growth, where Democratic women are doing so much better than Republican women, a big part of that has happened because of the work of Emily's List.
I kind of wondered, was thinking about Mary Taylor again and her support for gun rights and that kind of a thing. And, you know, she brought her assault weapon to a rally on the State House steps. But I don't know if she garnered any support from gun rights PACs. Marianne Sharkey?
You know, I don't know, Ian. I haven't really looked deeply in, but I know she was supported by, you know, the gun rights people.
Right.
They felt that she was stronger than Mike DeWine. They felt that Mike DeWine's record, even though he claimed to be a supporter, they thought she had a stronger record. So I believe she was supported by them. I just don't know how much money she got.
I wanted to talk about messaging a little bit, too. I don't hear a lot of women referencing Donald Trump, even though he inspired a lot of women to become involved. I don't hear a lot of them. What about that message, Debbie Walsh? Are you hearing a lot of anti-Trump rhetoric out there or not? Am I missing it?
You mean among the women who are running?
Yes.
I think that the women who are running are trying to run for something.
Yeah.
You know, I think they're talking a lot about policy. Particularly healthcare policy has been a big one. I think the environment. I mean, I think that in general, a smart campaign can't just run against something.
Mm-hmm.
I think Donald Trump may have inspired a lot of these women to run in the first place, but I think that they're running their campaigns on policy issues.
Mm-hmm. Wendy Smooth?
Oh, I would agree. And I would only add the gun control issue. And
We
start to look at women of color candidates, they're also looking at state-sanctioned violence or violence in their communities as another issue that is motivating both the voter turnout among women and then also candidates running for office. And I do want to land on voters for a second, because we're focused on the candidates. But one of the things, and Debbie, you guys may have a little bit of data to speak to this more directly, is that I'm a little concerned about the ways in which our voters will respond to women's losses. So we have all of this energy and people are very excited about, I guess it's been called the tidal wave this year,
right,
for women in politics. And so the message that I'd like to get out are to voters who are supportive of women candidates to say that you don't just support them the first time, you don't just give to the one race, but that you've got to get in this for, again, the long haul, and to understand that change in politics does not come swiftly. It comes after planting a seed, nourishing the seed, and watching it then grow. And so to whatever we can do to educate voters more about that process, I think women will be better served. So I hope that our messages are not just going to women candidates, but also going to voters who are interested and want to see more women in office to understand the process.
Absolutely.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll continue our conversation. You just heard from Wendy Smooth. She is a professor in the Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies Department at OSU. Also with us by phone, Debbie Walsh, director at the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers University, and Marianne Sharkey, political consultant and former politics editor at the Cleveland Plain Dealer. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Oh, Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. We're talking about women in politics. Female candidates captured one-third of the U.S. House nominations during the primaries last week. Still with us, professor in the Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies Department at OSU, Wendy Smooth, political consultant and former politics editor at the Cleveland Plain Dealer, Marianne Sharkey, and director at the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers University, Debbie Walsh. Questions or comments, give us a call. What do you think? Have you thought about running and then thought against it? Give us a call and tell us why. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The race in Pennsylvania, newly drawn 5th congressional race is being closely watched. That's today. 6 women are running in the Democratic primary. The incumbent announced in January that he would not seek re-election after revelations that he used taxpayer money to settle a sexual harassment complaint by a former aide. That's sort of that politics by scandal, Marianne Sharkey, I was referencing earlier. It's going to give him a boost, but 6 women running, is it all good?
Well, I know, you know, not necessarily, but I mean, this is clearly part of this V2 movement, which I applaud. I think that as more and more of these men get involved in these, you know, scandals, the better opportunity for women, and for better or for worse, we have really seen very few women get involved. There have been some exceptions in these scandals, and I think that it gives a great opportunity to move women forward in politics, because frankly, I think people are getting fed up with this and they're getting sick of these scandals.
You know, I live in New Jersey, and in our state, we talk about indictments have been very, very good to women. Because our increase that we've seen for women in our state legislature really came about in large part because we had quite a few men in one election cycle who had to leave under a cloud. And in every one of those cases, they were replaced by women, and that was done actually by the parties, because I think when the parties want to show voters a fresh face and a new face and an honest face, women are exactly the kind of candidate that they're looking for. And we don't actually have data, as Wendy knows, that says that women are more honest than men. But it certainly is the perception and the stereotype. Mm-hmm. So since we have to live with all the negative stereotypes, we might as well take advantage of some of those positive stereotypes and go with it. So I think that that can happen, you know, when there is a scandal and when then there is some sort of a transgression that voters want to look to somebody new. And it's great when women candidates are there and have stepped up and can take advantage of that.
So, you know, Debbie, I underscore, and Marianne, I underscore 2 points about that. So one, that changes the structure. So that becomes an open seat. So again, women in those situations are not having to run against an incumbent, which we're seeing for so many of the women who won in the primaries on Tuesday. The other thing that I want to underscore from that example, Debbie, you mentioned that the parties did that, right? Mm-hmm. So the parties stepped in and supported women candidates. Mm-hmm. And what we very well know from the wonderful research of our colleagues at COP is that the parties do make a difference. So the other group that should be listening and paying attention right now, the parties should be paying attention to the ways in which voters are responsive to women candidates. Pay attention to this energy of women who are stepping up to serve. Pay attention to the women who are organizing independent of the parties to get more women interested in politics. I'm thinking about like the Matriots group here in Central Ohio. The parties should be paying attention to those groups and what they're doing and who among those members are the next best candidate.
Women have always been the worker ants in the parties, haven't they, Marianne Sharkey, in Ohio particularly?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we elect judges in Ohio.
Right, yes.
And one area where women have done extremely well in Ohio politics is on the Ohio Supreme Court.
Yes.
We are Chief Justice. And the Republicans have put women on the ballot because they do draw more votes. And I saw it in Cuyahoga County where a number of women have won their elections on the benches. So they do well in the judicial politics.
What about term limits? In Ohio, they pitched term limits back in the 90s as a way for minorities and women to get more of a foothold. Debbie Walsh, any evidence of that?
None. And in fact, it's been, I think, one of the things that has caused the stagnation that we've seen. I think term limits sound great on the face of it, but what has to go with term limits then is a change in the way parties, and going back to Wendy's point, the role parties play, mm-hmm. but the way in which parties are recruiting and supporting candidates. So if you lose you lose people and you create these open seats, but if you're going to recruit in the exact same way you used to recruit, which means bringing more usually white men in, then that doesn't help you. And the other challenge is we lost women. I mean, women incumbents were termed out, and then we'd have to go out and replace those women. And for all kinds of reasons, it has been harder to get those women in office, to run for office, to step up. And so we lost not just women in state legislatures, but we lost leadership. I mean, you think about
Certainly.
In Ohio, Joanne Davidson is the Speaker right. of the House and
yes.
termed out of office. And then I think that becomes even more complicated because when you have a term-limited state like you do in Ohio, you mm-hmm. have to come into office kind of already jockeying for those high-level leadership positions because your time in there is short. And that, I think, is just harder for women. I think they kind of wait and want to see the lay of the land and get their legs, their sort of sea legs mm-hmm. Before they make that plunge. And they can lose out in those cases. So I think for all kinds of reasons, term limits have been a real problem for women and women's representation.
There are men serving in the Ohio General Assembly, Marianne Sharkey, you know this, that were there back in 100 years ago when I used to cover the Ohio General
right.
Assembly. They've been going back
right.
and forth between the House and the Senate. Sometimes
they're playing musical chairs, Anne. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, they you seem know, more comfortable doing that.
Sure.
They make an agreement with, a state rep and a state senator, and they agree to swap seats. And that's been going on forever, and I agree with you. It's amazing how many, how many people are still serving that I covered way back when. And I go around and I see them, and I'm surprised that they're still around.
Well, that's
so
the
term limits has not done anything in terms of just, getting the old guard out.
Sure, that's... I mean, Marianne, you would know this very well. That's the insider party politics within the state of Ohio, right? Where the agreements are all being made. The other piece for the term limits, I feel like I've been tossed back to graduate school with that question because term limits was such a big issue when I was studying. But the other piece that we don't speak enough about is the mentoring that happens between mm-hmm. the candidate that is sitting in office and once they've identified who they will desire to have their seat, the mentoring that takes place to get that person ready to take their seat, as Debbie said, while they are focused on the leadership role.
Yeah.
And we don't talk enough about
the role of the lobbyists,
sure.
too, because, they're throwing a lot of money in, say, for example, Larry Householder, who's running to become the speaker again in Ohio.
Again.
First yeah. Energy and a lot of others threw a lot of money into races for people who would vote for him to become the House Speaker. We're seeing the lobbyists taking a huge role in terms of, recruiting candidates and funding candidates. And frankly, they don't tend to choose women.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. There are a lot of forces at play, Debbie Walsh. It's not just parties. I mean, Marianne Sharkey brought up the very salient point of lobbyists and other kinds of groups that fund and show support for candidates.
Yeah, I mean, there are, when we think about all of the different challenges and the inside politics that's out there, it's the party leadership, it's the parties themselves, it's the lobbyists. This all is part of what goes into the election or the not election of someone. And I think one of the things that we found that's really important is that, women may not be you know, if they haven't been kind of enmeshed in that world and they come in as novices, which is a little of what I think we're seeing this year.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we saw in 1992, if you look at the women who got into Congress, those were women who were in the pipeline already. You know, most of those women who came in 92 that were part of that doubling of the women in Congress, in the House at least, these were women who were in state legislatures or in county government, and they knew how the politics worked. This year, we're seeing an awful lot of women who have never run before, who have never really been involved in politics before. And I think that's part of why they're, you know, running for some of these seats that are really tough. I think a lot of the more seasoned women would look at some of those races and say, you know, no chance, I'm staying where I am. This year, we're not seeing as much of that. So I think the kind of newness to politics, we're seeing that. And I think, as to speak to Wendy's point, in terms of the long game, mm-hmm. so these women are newcomers now, but in 2 years or 4 years, they won't be. You know, they're going to understand how this works a little bit better.
Right.
They may make some different kinds of choices. They may take advantage of the name recognition that they've built in this cycle and think about running in the future.
You know, one thing.
Well, let's face it, rarely are lobbyists looking for good government. And, I mean, that's just not on their agenda.
Yeah, not for
women are associated with good government. So there you go.
Yes, exactly.
Right,
they are.
Right. But you know, I wonder, kind of going back to this idea of the Trump effect, right? So in terms of inspiring all of these women to jump in, right, at these really competitive spaces, in these really competitive spaces, with backgrounds that we don't traditionally, you know, see the resume of, you've been in the legislature for 12 years and that sort of thing. I really believe that that is also a part of the Trump effect, right? So that this idea that you can do it, if he can do it, anybody can do it, right? And that it does not take this really long established political resume. And in some regard, that's exciting. And I want more women to do that. But I also want, if you don't have the success in terms of the win, that you also think about the name recognition.
You can't buy the name recognition that he had.
Well, yeah. Sure, absolutely. But what they get out of a loss, that we actually see that as a really huge, credible component. Another thing we haven't talked... Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Wendy.
No, I was just going to say another thing in terms of having these alternative ways of measuring success, right? We are talking about women in a midterm election. That is a huge...
Right off the bat, that's a success.
That's a huge success. And we're talking about what it takes to win. And we're talking about what you can learn from a loss. And we're talking about getting women educated around how to fund a campaign. Notice I didn't say how to raise the money, but how to fund a campaign. Mm-hmm. So, you know, citizens being interested. That's a whole different set of conversations than we're usually at this point.
I
count that as success.
Programs,
yep, I do
duly
too.
Noted. Are programs like the White House Project and those other kinds of programs to train and recruit female candidates, do those matter, Debbie Walsh?
Oh.
Yeah, well, sadly, the White House Project does not exist anymore.
Right.
But it's kind of what hits offshoot of that is Vote Run Lead. We do a nonpartisan campaign training program called Ready to Run, which I'm happy to say we have a partner in Ohio at the John Glenn School.
Mm-hmm.
So we're doing that work. I think that work does matter. I think that it demystifies politics. I think it gives women some clues and insights into what it takes to organize a campaign, to raise money. And frankly, it probably just gives them the confidence to do the thing that they probably could have done without the training in the first place. But women are good girls, and so they need to go and participate in the training. And so for that alone, it is worth it. It helps them build networks and connections so that when they do run a campaign, they know the right people to call, and they've met them, and there's a connection there. And I think that's really important, because one of the things we know is that women are more likely to run when they're recruited. Although I think in this election cycle, speaking to Wendy's point, you know, we used to kid about the fact that, well, you know, men wake up one morning, they look in the mirror and they say they'd be the best candidate and they just run for office, and women need to be recruited. But I think this time around what we saw was women woke up one morning back in November of 2016, turned on the television and said, wait, that guy is president of the United States. I can run for office. And I think that's what we're seeing this cycle.
Sure. I just have to underscore these groups. Groups like Higher Heights and Latinas Represent, who are focused on women of color in particular, it is a huge component to demystify the process, because we don't see the numbers of women of color in political office, and the networks, all of those things are immensely important to getting more women into office and the confidence needed to
succeed. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Wendy Smooth, professor of women's gender and sexuality studies at OSU, thanks for joining us again.
Oh, nice to be back.
Debbie Walsh, director of the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers University. Thanks again, Debbie.
Always fun.
Marianne Sharkey, political consultant and former politics editor at the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Thanks to you as well, Marianne. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Ann.
Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.